Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think a lot of it has to do with this sort of over-ordinancing, right? So it's hard to get fruit trees planted because they attract bees, which might sting people. They drop fruit onto the ground, which could be hazardous if you step on it and fall. It's messy.
Those are some of the reasons Megan Betts hypothesizes why community orchards aren't as ubiquitous as community gardens. She takes us on a tour of the Bloomington Community Orchard. From Harvest Public Media, why some say right-to-farm legislation pits farmer against farmer, and forensic testing to spot antibiotics in milk. Then we go on the hunt with an Indianapolis dumpster diver, and Chef Bob Adkins throws together some pickled eggs, all ahead. Luann Johnson is on holiday this week, so we've recruited Mark Chilla to read our news headlines.
Earth Eats bloggers have collected three stories from across the food landscape this week. Five reporters have been subpoenaed as part of a defamation lawsuit brought by a meat producer against ABC. Beef Products Incorporated sued the TV network over its coverage of so-called pink slime, or lean, finely textured beef. The corporation claims that ABC's misleading reporting resulted in consumer outcry and the closure of three production facilities. Food writers subpoenaed include Michelle Simon, Michael Moss from the New York Times, and three reporters from Food Safety News. They are being asked to supply copies of any communications they had with ABC in 2012. To find out what all the controversy is about lean, finely textured beef, do a search for pink slime at eartheats.org to access archived articles. Another story about the meat industry. Last year, the USDA proposed a rule that would require meat producers to include where livestock was born, raised, and slaughtered on labels. It's called the Country of Origin Labeling Law, or COOL. This week, it survived its second legal challenge from meatpackers and processors. Opponents like Cargill and Tyson Foods say COOL could affect the market for imported meat. Supporters say it will improve transparency of an industry that is becoming increasingly globalized. Compliance with the new labeling rule could cost the meat industry up to $190 million. That's according to the USDA. And when her son's ice cream sandwich refused to melt, a Cincinnati mother decided to investigate what exactly she was feeding her family. Christy Watson told WCPO Cincinnati that when her son left a Walmart Great Value brand ice cream sandwich outside overnight, the ice cream did not melt, despite the 80-degree temperatures. She inspected the box, but nowhere did it claim to be artificial. WCPO decided to investigate further, comparing Great Value ice cream products to Häagen-Dazs ice cream and a Klondike bar. All three products were set in the hot sun for an hour and measured for how much they melted. The Great Value ice cream hardly melted, while the Klondike bar partially melted. The Häagen-Dazs ice cream melted completely. Walmart argued that their ice cream contains more cream and therefore melts more slowly. Although cream does melt more slowly, that didn't hold up against Häagen-Dazs, whose simple ingredients include cream, milk, sugar, eggs, and vanilla. Both Great Value ice cream sandwiches and Klondike bars have stabilizers, like guar gum and cellulose gum. Both are classified as safe for human consumption by the FDA. The gums and other ingredients like corn syrup aren't enough for a product to be considered artificial, at least not by FDA standards. Our blogger, Liz Leslie, even dug up the definition of ice cream, according to the FDA. Read it and find links to all these news stories in this week's podcast post. That's at eartheats.org.
What about making your own ice cream? We've got a post about that, too, at eartheats.org. Join the conversation on our Twitter feed, which is where we post news stories like these 24/7. We're at Earth Eats. Mark Chilla reading our news. Thanks.
Anytime, Annie.
Agriculture is vital to most Midwestern states. That's why some states want to enshrine the so-called right to farm in the state constitution. Voters in Missouri will have a chance to vote on the issue next week. But though these right to farm amendments are focused on agriculture, they often pit farmer against farmer. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted has the story.
Good cow, sit.
Jeff Jones and his daughters drive a feed cart down the hill from their house to feed their foraging cattle.
Drive them away there, McKinley. They'll come back here. Suck, come on. the cow.
About a dozen cows saunter out from a shady grove to greet the buckets of grain. But Jones, a fourth-generation farmer, is worried about new neighbors. An industrial hog farm is slated to move in less than half a mile away. The 20-acre lot in rural Callaway County, Missouri, would pack in more than 10,000 hogs. Jones says he's concerned how it will affect the health of his livestock and family.
Much of the fertilizer will be spread on the land, which will be uphill from us. So, you know, in large rains, there's going to be, you know, concerns about that coming down here and being in the water in the creek and the ditches and things like that.
It's a common story. Industrial ag and neighbors don't always mix. But Jones is worried that he won't be able to hold the hog operation accountable for problems. That's if Missouri voters approve an amendment to the state constitution. It's being called a right to farm amendment, and it could serve as a model for constitutional additions in other farm-heavy states. As proposed, it says in part, the right of farmers and ranchers to engage in farming and ranching practices shall forever be guaranteed in the state. The measure essentially attempts to protect farmers and ranchers from any new laws that would change or outlaw practices that they currently use.
Practices that are proven, that are safe, that are good for consumers, good for farmers, and good for the environment.
Blake Hurst, president of the Missouri Farm Bureau, says his organization supports the amendment. He wants to stay one step ahead of the groups that use regulation to change the way farmers do business. Some Midwest farmers say they feel under attack from animal welfare groups and environmental organizations. They're worried about their livelihood.
So this amendment is a way for us to sort of push back a little bit.
The amendment has become a hot-button issue. On one side, commodity groups like the Missouri Cattlemen's Association and the Poultry Federation. On the other, animal rights groups like the Humane Society and some small farmers. One of the issues is vague language. If the amendment is approved, it will likely lead to interpretation disputes down the road. Here's University of Missouri law professor Erin Morrow-Holly.
It talks about farming and ranching practices. So that's a rather general term. It will be left much to the courts to decide what that encompasses.
Now, if the amendment passes, farms will still have to abide by existing laws and environmental regulations. But critics say it would make the state friendlier to industrial farms with deep pockets.
Those out here in the country, we're just going to get screwed with this patent.
That's Joe Maxwell, former lieutenant governor of Missouri and head of a group opposing the amendment. He says the law could result in more power for big farmers and companies and allow them to fund changes in local laws.
If this passes, those safeguards will be under attack by those that want to build large CAFOs in rural Missouri.
Farm Bureau President Blake Hurst maintains that the amendment is meant to protect all of the state's farmers, and the opposition may be much ado about nothing. 2 years ago, North Dakota passed a similar right-to-farm amendment. North Dakota State University law professor David Sikowski says he hasn't seen any resulting court cases.
Maybe sometime in the next decades, there will be some technology that even producers are going to say, hey, wait, we really aren't sure if we want that within our industry. And at that point, this language will be tested.
Back at the farm, Jeff Jones is also looking to the future.
It is going to put even more pressure on the traditional family farms.
Ultimately, in states where agriculture is a large chunk of the economy, voters will look at what needs protection. Missouri will decide on the August 5th ballot. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a Midwestern reporting collaboration. In the second half of our show today, CSI Agriculture, we learn more about how forensic testing can help detect food contamination. The two fig trees were the pride and joy of many involved with the Bloomington Community Orchard. Cuttings from a tree in Philadelphia were brought to southern Indiana to see if they could survive the harsh Midwestern winters. I'm at the orchard today, and Megan Betts is telling me a little good news, bad news about the fig trees. Good news, they survived the winter, and what a nasty polar vortex of a winter it was. Bad news, they did not survive the voles. If you've never seen a vole, it looks a little bit like a mouse. Betts studies community orchards at Indiana University, and she's also a former board member of the Bloomington Community Orchard. She describes how the fig trees were put to bed for the winter, wrapped in newspaper and fabric, and then encased in plastic bags for insulation.
But then it's like a nice, warm, food-filled home for voles. So the voles sort of ate through the outer layer and then just kept going and killed it.
You win some, you lose some when it comes to urban food forestry. Betts takes me on a tour of the orchard, which is arranged in circles. The strawberries are in the middle, surrounded by apple and peach trees trained into an espalier. That means the branches have been tied and spread out in such a way that air circulates freely through the leaves. The idea is to keep moisture away from the fruit. But I'm not seeing much fruit on these trees.
Yeah. I'm looking at the trees there. They're gorgeous and green. It's also 78 degrees at the end of July. It's definitely weird. So we had basically zero blossoms on any of the peaches and plums. The blackberries are still sort of coming in. We have what looks like, you know, at least another week or two of blackberries, which feels late to me. I mean, I'm not an expert, but it definitely feels like everything has slowed down. And I personally see fewer apples than I did last year. So it's weird. It's nice not to be watering, but not having peaches is sad.
Betts studies community orchards partly because there's just not a lot written about them, especially when you compare it to the community garden movement. Planting orchards is still a new phenomenon. She says many cities still make it too difficult to plant food trees.
I think a lot of it has to do with this sort of over-ordinancing, right? So it's hard to get fruit trees planted because they attract bees, which might sting people. They drop fruit onto the ground, which could be hazardous if you step on it and fall. It's messy. It takes a lot more care. You need to be pruning. They're much more fragile for the first couple years of their life. So asking a public entity to take it on is demanding a lot more resources, a lot more manpower. And when you plant a tree, you're thinking about, you know, 20, 30, 50 years versus when you ask for a community garden plot, if it needs to come out the next season, it can.
Luckily for the Bloomington Community Orchard, they have a passionate volunteer base as well as support from the city government. She goes back to this idea of over-ordinancing.
Most cities, most towns in the United States have ordinances about how tall your grass can be and what you can plant on your front lawn versus your back lawn. So I think it's going to be breaking down these smaller things before people say, okay, I'm totally fine with my city planting, you know, apple trees that are going to drop apples all over the place. I think there's still just not really even a public awareness to push local government for that yet. There are just some things that people seem like they would be uncomfortable with. Once you start talking to them, it ends up not being the case. And once you start talking to local government, it ends up not being the case. But until they start talking to each other, there's no real push forward.
They brought bees onto the site a couple years ago, for instance. Betts says there was some initial hesitation, but all the city required was that they put a kennel around the hives. They also posted a sign alerting visitors to the bees, and there have been no incidents. Megan Betts is the communications team leader at the Bloomington Community Orchard. Next week, she'll discuss her research about how people and communities use orchards. One bad apple don't spoil the whole bunch, girl. Coming up, we're pickling some eggs.
There's really only one surefire way I've ever known to boil eggs, and boiling's a misnomer.
But first, a lesson in cooking eggs with Chef Bob Atkins. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Hey, chicken farmers, are you overloaded with eggs this time of year? Giving them away is always good and a perk for your friends, but have you ever tried pickling eggs? Chef Bob Adkins will be giving us a demo today.
I always remember my grandmother having a big jar of pickled eggs with beets, and there were these bright pink pickled eggs and the pickled beets all in there. And it's something I really enjoy, something that you used to see a lot of times, you know, in bars and old saloons and stuff like that. And they're really easy to do.
There are really only three steps to this recipe: cooking the eggs, preparing the brine, and then waiting. I was surprised to hear that I've been boiling eggs all wrong my entire life. Chef Adkins has some pro tips.
There's really only one surefire way I've ever known to boil eggs. And boiling is a misnomer, because really you want to simmer. If you're boiling, you're agitating, you're breaking shells. So you start with the 30 eggs in a pot large enough to hold them. Cover them by at least 2 to 3 inches of cold water. Put them on a high heat. You bring them up to one boil, you turn off the heat, cover them, let them sit off the heat for 10 to 15 minutes. After that, some ice water to shock the eggs. So while the eggs are coming up, you can prepare your brine. So I have 8 cups of malt vinegar. To that, I'm going to add some fresh ingredients. I've got one large Spanish onion, 2 jalapenos sliced down. The size doesn't really matter. So it's just you're lending the flavor to it. Some garlic, which is going to give it a different type of spice. We're also going to add some red crushed chili flakes. We're adding about 1/4 cup of fennel seeds, about 1 tablespoon of dried oregano, some whole black peppercorns, a little fresh rosemary and thyme, about 3 sprigs of rosemary and 6 sprigs of thyme, a few bay leaves, one of our all-time favorites in pickling. We're going to add 1/4 cup of kosher salt, all to the mix there. And you could add other things to this. I mean, really, the sky's the limit. Right now, I'm waiting for the brine to come up and heat up a little bit for all those flavors to marry. We boiled and peeled the eggs, of course, or simmered the eggs. We're going to cut a little slit in a crosshatch pattern on the egg, just down to the yolk, so that it's going to allow that pickling brine to penetrate a little bit quicker. So we're going to do that to all of our eggs. I'm going to pour the hot brine directly over, and I have here just a stainless steel soup tureen, and then you can transfer them to something else after they've cooled. These will be ready in 2 days minimum. I would love to let them sit a week, and they're going to last a long time under refrigeration in that pickling brine. And the longer they sit, I think the better they get.
Bob Adkins' recipe for pickled eggs at eartheats.org. Farmers treat sick cows with antibiotics, but no one wants to ingest any medicine with their cold glass of milk. Routine testing aims to keep dairy products safe, but in a move borrowed from law enforcement, veterinarians can now add forensics to the tools they use to check milk. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
Guy's a monster. Doesn't know his own strength.
Well, he's about to know ours.
TV shows like CSI have made forensics a hot topic. The same technology used at crime scenes to link a hair to a suspect can also find antibiotics in milk, something Brooklyn, Iowa dairy farmer Doreen Bolin works hard to avoid.
We actually had a problem like a month ago.
A worker on her farm used a medical treatment appropriately, but he didn't segregate the cow and allow the antibiotics to flush out of her system.
He made a mistake, and we had antibiotics in our milk.
It cost Bolin 2 loads of milk. That kind of contamination could be prevented with forensic testing. Hans Kutzia is a professor at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine and helps run the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab.
Every now and then things happen on production systems where an animal might have inadvertently been exposed to a drug that they shouldn't have received, or there's some quality assurance steps that a veterinarian might want to take to ensure that the animals are not receiving a medicated feed, for example.
The machines here use mass spectrometry, a process that can break a sample down and identify even the tiniest components within. Kutzia says veterinarians can submit milk, meat, and animal feed samples for testing. One reason they might is to protect exports. He says other countries may monitor entering food with more exacting tests than what products are subject to here before leaving our borders.
In many cases, they use their testing capabilities as a trade barrier. And so it's very important, especially within the state of Iowa, where export of meat products is an important aspect of our economy, to ensure that the animals that do leave the state meet the requirements of our trading partners.
The Iowa State Lab can match or exceed the international tests. To be clear, all milk is tested now, and the Food and Drug Administration sets tolerance limits. For penicillin, for example, that's zero. Amoxicillin is 0.01 parts per million in milk or meat. The mass spectrometry allows for detection of even trace amounts and could also find components the FDA doesn't yet regulate. For now, the most likely application is testing milk after a mix-up to prevent the kind of problem Bolin had.
You're always going to have human error, and somebody gave something the wrong drug or applied the wrong insect control to the farm.
That's livestock veterinarian Matthew Bogert. He says most farmers are vigilant about using only approved medicines in the intended ways. Still, he says, the lab could help him catch a wrongdoer.
If I had a client that was toeing the line with stuff and I was trying to convince him to stop, this would be a great test for that.
And who knows, with the increasing attention placed on where food comes from and what's in it, maybe a future season will be CSI on the Farm. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
They do great work at Harvest Public Media. There are stories about food, fuel, and field at harvestpublicmedia.org. When we interview folks for Earth Eats, one of the most important things we do is ask people to say and spell their names. With this conversation, I'd actually forgotten to ask him to do that until the interview was over.
Thank you so much. Oh, I think I didn't have you say your name and spell your name.
Oh, what?
Do you not want your name?
I kind of don't, for the sake of future Google searches. That's one thing I hate. I hate when people, when the first thing people know about me is, oh, that's he digs through the trash. That's weird. I love that. It's part of what I do. I'm okay with people knowing that. I just hate when that's the first thing that they know about me, because I get pigeonholed.
So for anonymity's sake, let's just call him John Q. Dumpster Diver. I know, dumpster diving. It might not seem like the safest or certainly the most legal thing to do, but when you consider the recent USDA study showing that in 2010 retail stores threw away 10% of the entire edible food supply, that's 43 billion with a B pounds of food, Mr. Dumpster Diver might just be onto something. I met him behind a grocery store in downtown Indianapolis, where he showed me some of the tricks of the trade.
I've never done this before, but you say you're not worried.
I'm not worried. No, I used to be concerned about whether or not it was legal, and now I'm just concerned more about whether or not it's moral. And I feel like, I don't know if it's legal. I think it is.
It's the trespassing thing that would potentially be a problem.
That's what I understand, but you know, if they tell me to leave, I leave. I don't put up a fight, and I just try and make sure that I'm not memorable.
Well, so we're walking around back now. We're approaching the dumpster in downtown Indy behind an Aldi's. That'll be about as specific as we get about our location. How about that?
Yeah, that's fine. And it's completely empty except for a pack of bananas. They're in good shape. I actually think I might grab them. It's kind of a bust, and that happens sometimes. Just kind of luck of the draw, I guess.
Bananas, you got, I don't know, a dozen bananas. You can make some killer banana bread out of that. I say that's lucky today.
It's, I don't know. They're not in the best shape. There's a couple in here that I might, you know, be able to eat over the next couple days. I don't know if I'll, I'm not the world's greatest baker, but my wife's pretty good, so.
There you go.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about grocery shopping in Western culture. You know, we want the best value for our product, so we don't want to buy things that have like a banana, you know, a banana that has a brown spot on it. We don't want to buy an apple that has like a blemish on it. We don't want to buy a can of beans that has a dent in it, so it all winds up in the trash.
So we're at an Aldi's right now. Tell me how you found this spot as a good spot to come and dumpster dive.
Just driving past, if I've got a lunch break or something, and I see a grocery store nearby, I might give it a shot and see what's up. Sometimes I'm lucky, sometimes I'm not. Early today, I went out and I swung by another location and found a bunch of tomatoes, a bunch of lettuce. Actually, also found a bunch of bird seed. I feed my chickens too out of the trash a lot too. I've got four chickens in my backyard, and they are not picky eaters, so I, you know, supplement their diet with some dumpster finds.
I bet they love that. Is there anything you will not take from a dumpster?
I don't take food that I don't like. I used to draw the line at meat, but that line has blurred drastically. And I feel like my life is better for it, because I have, believe it or not, never got sick from eating anything out of the trash. Anything that I feed to friends or family, you know, I hold to a higher scrutiny than something that I would just eat myself. Yeah, I love feeding people. I love cooking for people. Dumpster diving has made me a better cook for sure, because I come home with a bunch of random ingredients and I got to find a way to use them. So, you know, I find some way to use them, but I don't want, you know, someone else's food poisoning on my shoulders. So I'm willing to get food poisoning myself, but I don't want to put anyone else through that. So I'm more careful if I'm feeding other people with it.
What's like the greatest, most amazing dumpster find that you've had?
Ice cream's a really good find. If you can find that and it's still cold, like they just threw it out, then it just kind of feels like you're just in the right spot at the right time and everything in the world is right.
Our anonymous John Q. Dumpster Diver, doing his part to combat retail food waste one grocery store dumpster at a time. More stories about dumpster diving, food waste, and ice cream at eartheats.org.
Oh, I love trash. Anything.
A whole group of people helped make Earth Eats possible, thanks to Bob Atkins, Megan Betts, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Good times this week. Thanks for being here and sharing it with us. For Earth Eats, I'm Annie Corrigan.